This is the Signs of the Times commentary. A look at the world from around our kitchen table.
We have the three Signs of the Times editors around the table today. I'm Joe Quinn.
I'm Henry C.
And I'm Scott Ogren. But first, a brief introduction to our work for those of you who may not know us. Signs of the Times is a daily commentary on news, politics, and the general craziness of the world around us, including anomalous phenomena that don't generally make it into the mainstream press. Our website is found at www.signs-of-the-times.org. The Signs page is now in its fourth year, and we have a searchable archive available on our site if you want to get more details on some of the stories that have been in the news during that time.
In the news is an interesting way to put it, because in many cases these stories haven't made it into the mainstream news, at least not in the United States, where only, I think it's 12 or 17% of the population get their news from the Internet. But these stories do get covered in other countries, and that's why it's necessary to get your information from a variety of sources. Since we've started doing the Signs page, we get quite a bit of mail every week. Some of it's supportive, some of it not. But one of the things that some of our readers have a hard time coming to grips with is that we don't have a political line that we push. Because we do a serious amount of Bush bashing, people on the right in the United States think that we're Democrats, while people on the left tend to dismiss our openness to certain oddball topics or questions of spirituality or esotericism because they're still caught in the illusion that we can change the world, an illusion that we shed long ago.
Exactly. Our sole interest and goal is to get as objective a look at reality as possible. This process obviously involves leaving aside our own prejudices, preconceptions, and socialization. Needless to say, better minds than ours have been trying to change the world for thousands of years and have achieved little success. In fact, the world has probably never been in a bigger mess or on the verge of a greater catastrophe than it is at the present moment in history.
We might also point out that we each come from a different country and background. We have an American, a Canadian, and an Irishman. And these different backgrounds help us to get outside of the programming that we each received growing up because it gives us the opportunity to compare and contrast our reactions to world events.
So next we'll take a look at the bus and tube bombings in London today. The soft sell on this has been going on ever since 9/11. People have been expecting that there would be a second Al-Qaeda attack in the Western countries. Of course, there was Madrid just prior to the elections in March of 2004. And now today, as the G8 summit in Glen Eagles was getting off, there was the bombing in London.
Yeah, which is an important point and an interesting point, the fact that the London bus and tube bombings happened on the very same day, or indeed on the day that the G8 leaders were meant to announce to the world their plan for fighting poverty in Africa. Certainly over the past week with the Live Aid concerts around the world, the focus had definitely been on what the developed countries had not been doing and how they had been abusing their power, their positions of power, to essentially get rich from the suffering and the poverty of African peoples, as well as other peoples around the world in so-called developing countries. So it was very interesting that these attacks actually happened today, because what they served to do, obviously, was to totally shift the focus away from the responsibility of our leaders to combat poverty and suffering in third world countries, and focused it straight on to the ubiquitous war on terror.
And we had Tony Blair, when he gave his first statement at noon today, he made this particularly outrageous remark where he said, "It is particularly barbaric. This has happened on a day when people are meeting to try to help the problems of poverty in Africa and the long-term problems of climate change and the environment."
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly cynical of him to say that, given that Gordon Brown, the Chancellor, the UK Finance Minister, essentially, stated that the campaigners, the Live Aid campaign and the campaigners, the protesters in the streets should not. He didn't even say that they should not get their hopes up. He said that they should be prepared for a disappointment, basically intimating that there was going to be no real solution to third world poverty. There was going to be no real cutting of any meaningful debt to these countries. So it was very cynical of Blair to then use the idea that the G8 leaders were actually going to do something. And
then we had this other statement that Blair made when he says, whatever they do, it is our determination that they will never succeed in destroying what we hold dear in this country and in other civilized nations throughout the world. And, of course, this coming from the head of the British Empire, which used armies to civilize the savages, including back in the 1920s, the use of gas on people in Iraq. It's quite an outrageous statement, and you see the...
Talk about chemical weapons and evil tyrants having chemical weapons. The first use of chemical weapons was by the then, I suppose you could still call it the then British Empire, that used gas essentially as a test, to test the effectiveness of gas and chemical weapons on Iraq. What was to become Iraq.
And we see the reemergence of the typically colonialist discourse, where we have the civilized nations on the one hand and then the savages that the white man is going to go out and save.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact that it came, the bombings in London came on this particular day was very very significant. And it leads into the idea of the so-called terrorist attacks that have happened over the past few years. For example, the Madrid train bombing and even terrorist attacks in Iraq. One of the most interesting things about them is that these so-called Islamic or Arab terrorists seem to have no problem about killing either their own people or people in European countries that are sympathetic to their cause, because this was the case in the last year in March 11th, 2004's Madrid train bombing, where approximately 190 people were killed, all of them basically just simple working class people on the trains in the morning. And the thing about Spain is that it was estimated that about 90% of the population of Spain were actually against the Iraq war. So why would Islamic or Arab terrorists want to indiscriminately kill large numbers of Spanish or even any European peoples that actually essentially, to some degree, supported their cause?
And that was something we saw in the run-up to the Iraqi war, the illegal invasion, that you had the so-called terrorist taking over of the theater in Moscow, where Putin was actively against the United States trying to force the UN to come to an agreement to support the invasion. You had a French ship that was attacked, and France was also one of the strong opponents to Bush's plans. You had the bomb that went off in Bali that was aimed at Australian vacationers, and even if the Australian government was in support, the Australian people themselves, like the Spanish people, like the French, like the Italians, were very much against it. So it was this curious sequence of the supposed Islamic fundamentalist terrorists attacking the people who were their biggest supporters around the world.
Yeah, I mean, they essentially seem to be supporting the agenda of Bush and Blair and Berlusconi and Aznar, the Spanish Prime Minister at the time, these so-called Arab terrorists were actually, attacking the people who had marched and demonstrated against these European leaders. So certainly there seems to be a common agenda there, at least circumstantially, between the European leaders and Bush, the pro-war European leaders and the Bush administration, and these so-called Islamic or Arab terrorists.
Which raises the question of a false flag operation.
Exactly. What about the crazy idea? And it's not so much a crazy idea, really. The simple idea that you identify your enemy and then you essentially carry out an attack and blame him. I mean, it's a theory or it's a tactic that really is as old as the hills. But so many people have such a problem accepting that it could even be a core aspect of intelligence agencies' strategy.
When you look at what happens in the period prior to a war, in the early stages of a war, you need to demonize your enemy. We saw that with Saddam, where all of a sudden Saddam was being compared to Hitler. Saddam, even though he had been a strong friend of the United States for many years, was receiving chemical weapons and other weapons from the United States on a dime. Public opinion was made to turn around, and so you get the demonization. And what better way to demonize your enemy than to carry out some sort of a horrifying attack like this against innocent men, women, and children, and blame it on your enemy? Right there, you have a surefire way of categorizing a whole people as being less than human. And we saw this happen in 9/11.
Yeah, certainly,
in New York.
Certainly, but we can go back a lot further than 9/11 for historical precedents for this idea of a false flag operation. And when we say false flag operation, the term just comes from the idea of, it's probably fairly intuitive, but it's just to explain, it's raising a false flag. It's you carry out an attack and then you wave a flag of the flag of your enemy, identifying them as the perpetrators of the attack. And historical precedents for this include certainly in the past maybe 10 or 12 years, the release of, under the Freedom of Information Act, the word documents, specifically the Northwood documents that were released, which essentially were evidence, documents from a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the early 60s, where the American Joint Chiefs of Staff had got together and decided how best they were going to encourage or garner public support for an invasion of Cuba to overthrow Castro. So basically what these wonderful people, the so-called leaders, decided upon was to bomb a U.S. airliner, blow a U.S. airliner full of people up, and then blame it on Cuba. So this idea of a false flag operation goes back a long time, and is evidence for the fact that it really has been a mainstay of the thinking of these types of people.
And we've seen it also regularly occurring in Palestine. If you remember back just over a year ago, when the International Court came out with its ruling on the apartheid wall separating the occupied territories and from the Israel, the day of the announcement, there was a so-called suicide bombing in Tel Aviv.
Exactly. Yeah, the World Court had ruled that the wall was illegal, and that it did not really contribute to Israel's fight against Palestinian terrorism. That it wasn't
to its security.
Yeah, and to the security of Israel. And as if to confirm or to reject the World Court's ruling, these, again, we have to say, so-called Palestinian terrorists decided that they would infiltrate Israel bypassing the wall and committing an attack against the Israeli population as if to just, you know, prove Sharon's point that that the wall was actually needed. Now, you got to wonder, when things like that happen, just who really is behind these attacks.
Because as soon as the Palestinians start getting some quote-unquote good press, something like this happens, and the court ruling is no longer in the headlines. It's bloodthirsty Arabs killing poor defenseless Israelis.
Exactly. It's a perfect example of what we're talking about.
Every time there's any sort of peace deal that's about to be brokered, the Palestinian terrorists, quote-unquote, seem to shoot themselves in the foot.
And today it was interesting as well, because an early report after the London bombings said that former Israeli Prime Minister and current Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was in London at the time, early reports were saying that he had been warned just prior to the first bombing not to leave his hotel to go to a conference on the Israeli economy that was being held in London. This, of course, was very, very quickly denied by the Israeli foreign minister. And
yeah, the interesting thing with that is that you had conflicting statements, and it's one of the things that we notice after a lot of these attacks, that in the immediate aftermath there's a lot of conflicting statements, which on one hand may not seem that strange, because there's a lot of stuff going on and there's different stories coming out, but certainly in terms of what we're looking at, in that it probably was not Arab terrorists that carried out this attack, and that it may well have involved the Israelis or the Israeli intelligence agency. It's certainly interesting that on the one hand you had the British Metropolitan Police saying that they had received a warning from the Israeli embassy that the bomb attacks were going to occur, and at the same time you had the Israeli embassy saying that they had received attacks from the Metropolitan Police that the bomb attacks were going to occur. And then afterwards, both of them denied that any of this happened.
Which takes us back to the early hours after 9/11, when there were reports that the Israeli firm Odigo, that the two employees of Odigo, had received emails just prior to the 9/11 attacks warning them. Of course, after this report started to emerge in the press, it was immediately retracted and then denounced as being anti-Semitic. However, in 2004, the head of Odigo came out and admitted that this had happened. As well, Mossad has already carried out some false flag operations in London. There was a bombing of the Israeli embassy there in 1994, and two Palestinians were eventually convicted for this. But there was also an article that came out in The Independent, a British daily, in November 1998, and this article made the point that the person, one of the people who'd been accused of the bombing of the Israeli embassy in London, Rita Maghribi, was actually an agent who'd been recruited by Mossad and who had been assigned by Israeli foreign intelligence to this particular operation.
Yeah, so it's, you know, one thing that really has to be understood to really get a grasp of the reality of the situation is that, going back to, for example, even to the Second World War, you know, you had, leading up to the Second World War, you had the Nazi threat to Europe and to America and to the world, with the Nazis, with Mussolini, with Franco in Spain, this fascist threat that was threatening to take over the civilized world. Obviously, during the Second World War, that threat was basically went away. It was defeated with the fall of the Nazi regime. But very shortly thereafter, a new threat du jour came along, this all-encompassing kind of menace that was threatening against civilized. And when we say civilized, we're really talking about Western capitalist countries. And just to make clear, we're just using that term capitalism, but we're not espousing any other kind of ideology like communism or anything like that. It's just to define it. So immediately after the Second World War, you had this, the communists, the Reds under the bed, the witch hunts, the commies are coming to get us, and all of this was used. This was essentially a fake threat with the Cold War and everything. It was a faked threat to the West, and essentially it was a threat that was used to the greatest extent by the Americans, by successive American governments, to essentially justify invasions and overthrowing various governments around the world, governments that essentially were socialist governments, were governments of the people, for the people, who as much as they could have been. So it was the U.S. government's attempt to essentially, and it succeeded in most cases, of removing any kind of leftist leaning or socialist governments that were essentially seeking to do right by their people, to impose some kind of representative, not impose, but to institute some kind of a representative government where there was, you know, proper social security, social services, etc., etc., and to deny, and such governments were not very likely to allow large American or European corporations to come in and essentially pillage their country and the country's wealth, particularly for oil and natural resources. So this communist threat throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, right up until the fall or the collapse of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and this was used all through those years to essentially impose what is today known as globalization, or the opening up the markets of essentially many, many countries around the world to large American corporations, including all, any kind of corporation you can think of, but most particularly oil companies for oil exploration in the various countries around the world that had large reserves of oil.
And it's also interesting to see how, during that period, the threat of the bomb was so important in terms of psychologically weakening the population so that they would willingly follow the crazy policies that their governments wanted to impose. Growing up in the 50s and 60s, there was a continual sense of dread of the atom bomb. And people in the West, especially in the United States, were worrying about whether they needed a bomb shelter in their backyard. And the psychological effect on people was quite frightening. And you see that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and all of a sudden the communist threat wasn't there, and there was this rise of a sense of hope among people. Would finally we be able to get out of this horrible dialectic that had been engulfing the world? And now we see that the war on terror is serving the same thing as the fear of the atomic bomb was 40 years ago.
Exactly,
it's,
yeah.
You don't know when it can happen. You don't know where it's going to strike. It's there. It's a permanent sword hanging over your head constantly.
Exactly, with the death of the Red Devil, I suppose, at the end of the 80s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, immediately, hot on the heels of that collapse, you had Islamic terrorism gaining more and more recognition in the press and around the world, and being pushed more and more particularly by the American government, as a new threat to civilization. So it, basically, the Islamic terrorism is basically the new communism, the new communist threat of today. And the point is that all of these threats were manufactured. They seemed very, very real, and to a lot of people were sure that the Arab terrorist or Islamic terrorist threat seems very, very, very real. But the point is that if you look at history and look at the way, look at the nature of governments and the thinking of their intelligence agencies and the way they go about plotting to essentially impose a world hegemony.
Well, it's important that they maintain a climate of fear.
Yes. So, I mean, basically what we're saying here is that the Islamic terrorist threat supplanted or has replaced the communist threat, and that it's essentially a fake threat, and it's simply used by governments of Western governments. When we mean Western governments, we mean mainly European governments and the American government, to scare the population into supporting their wars for profit. And it works very, very well, and it's ongoing to this day. And it started, you know, many, many years ago, specifically after the Second World War, and it's just something that we maybe want to talk a little bit about, because it's been raised in the press recently, in the mainstream press recently, although there was no real, as is so often the case today, there was no real investigative journalism done. In fact, that the story in the news that references this idea of false flag terror attacks or intelligence agencies posing as terror groups and carrying out attacks is actually linked to the recent story about Karl Rove being the person who outed Valerie Plame as a CIA agent in 2004. Because her husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, had been publicly, or had been certainly planning to publicly denounce or reject or claim as false the Bush administration's allegations that Saddam had been attempting to procure uranium to make nuclear bombs from Niger. The source, as it turned out, of these, what came to be called the Niger documents, was a member of the Italian intelligence service.
Who had connections with people like Michael Ledeen, the notorious neocon military strategist, and Rumsfeld, and the entire neocon...
The cabal.
Yeah, basically, it was part of the whole neocon takeover, I suppose, of the Defense Department in the U.S., along with Rumsfeld in league with certain neocons, Ledeen being one of them, set up a separate operation called the Office of Special Plans, which was essentially an organization that operated beyond the knowledge of Congress and beyond, supposedly, the knowledge of the president as well, where they would assign agents, their own hand-picked agents, to go and carry out certain black ops, as they call them, special operations around the world. And this was all funded by what they called black budgets as well, which were probably funded by the well-known drug running that the CIA has been involved in for many, many years.
All of this ties into what was known as Operation Gladio.
So basically, this was, as we were stating, the Niger documents that were proven to be fake and false by Joe Wilson, the husband of Valerie Plame, who was then outed by Karl Rove as retaliation for him stating that they were fake. How dare he out the U.S. government as having told a lie? These documents came from an Italian intelligence agent. And this also ties into a very recent story in the press about a Italian judge who ordered the arrest of 13 alleged CIA agents who had abducted or kidnapped a Muslim cleric from Italy, from Milan, and taken him to Egypt for torture or whatever they do to these people in these detention centers. It was also revealed that this Muslim cleric was actually an asset of this same covert group that Rumsfeld had been had set up to carry out these operations beyond the site of Congress. So this Muslim cleric was essentially an asset, an informer for this group. He would infiltrate Arab groups and feed the information back to this group, essentially just for intelligence gathering. But as we'll discuss a little later, it had nothing to do with protecting the American people from terrorist attacks. It had and had a lot to do with actually ultimately carrying out terrorist attacks and blaming it on the Iraqi insurgency. So the point about this is that this group of American agents were not really part of, it's possible that they were not really part of the standard of the official US CIA, for example, but were a covert black operations unit that really didn't have much to do with the CIA, but was under the direction and the control of Rumsfeld and the other neocons that essentially control and dictate policy in Washington at the minute. So, yeah, so all of this actually ties back into what we mentioned a few minutes ago, which was the Operation Gladio, which was essentially a group set up again by the Americans after World War II. They were also called the Stay Behind Group. And the idea was that because of the newfound communist threat, the phony communist threat, these groups were ostensibly in place in various countries around the world to stay behind in the event that some kind of communist or socialist government would take over that country. Not so much take over, but essentially just rise to power, probably in a democratic and normal way. And in the event of that happening, because any kind of a socialist or communist government gaining power was such a terrible thing from the point of view of American corporations and American dominance of the world, these groups were employed, or their agenda or their role was to carry on a guerrilla war against any kind of communist or socialist government that came to power.
And we should point out that the stay-behind networks were made up in many cases of former fascists or fascist supporters.
Exactly. A lot of them were actually members of the Nazi party, of the German Nazi regime, who were offered the opportunity, let's say, to work within these groups in exchange for no charges being brought against them for their crimes in Nazi Germany. As someone once pointed out, the Nazis didn't actually lose World War II, they just retreated to America.
This ties into Operation Paperclip, which was a major operation following World War II, where the United States brought into the country former supporters of the Nazis, former Nazis, scientists, people like Wernher von Braun, and to beef up the American military and the space program. So quite a number of Nazis. I think one number I read was close to 200,000 of them were given safe conduct and were established to work with the U.S. government.
Yeah, so just to give some concrete examples of the activities of these stay-behind groups or stay-behind network, also known at the time as the actual operation, at the time was called Operation Gladio, Gladio being the Latin word for sword. In 1982, in August 1982 to be exact, they carried out a train bombing.
A train bombing.
Not unlike the train bombing in London on Thursday, July 7th, 2005.
Or the train bombing in Madrid in March of 2004.
Yes, not unlike any of those, this stay-behind group, which was essentially made up of a ragtag bunch of mercenaries, you could probably call them, from various places, including from America, but most importantly financed by the American government. They carried out a train bombing in Bologna on August 2nd, 1982, and murdered 85 Italian civilians. And the reason they did this was because at the time, the Communist Party in Italy was gaining more and more ground, and they were actually planning. The Communist Party had been, the Italian Prime Minister at the time had more or less agreed to share power with the Communist Party. So this Gladio group, financed by the US, essentially planted a bomb in Bologna on a Bologna train and killed 85 civilians, and then coincidentally left evidence, quote unquote, indicting the Communist Party or the members of the Communist Party. In fact, it's very, very similar to what Hitler did in 1933 in the Reichstag fire, where
a communist was accused of setting fire to the Reichstag.
Well, exactly. He was accused of being a communist. There's debate over actually whether he was actually a communist or not, or whether he was actually aware of what he actually was, because it seems that historical documents would suggest that he was actually mentally retarded, and the Nazi Party at the time blamed him, and he was just one guy, and they claimed that he burned down the Reichstag, the German Parliament building, and this was used as an excuse to impose or to bring in or pass draconian laws and legislation clamping down on civil liberties in Germany at the time. This is what these kind of stay-behind networks or the Operation Gladio were all about. They were essentially involved in false flag operations back in the late 40s, and from then right the way through to today, because it seems that this group that the Italian judge has ordered to be arrested are actually members of the same type of organization, again financed and funded and backed by the US government or by a faction within the US government, because it seems that there always has been a faction within the US government that operated above and beyond the control and the awareness of Congress. So this group that have been operating in Italy, rendering various Muslim clerics from Italy.
Chris Floyd, who writes for he writes a weekly column for the Moscow Times, did a piece on Operation Gladio. And for those of you who think that we may just be spinning wild conspiracy theories with no documentary proof, Floyd found a document, or actually it was unearthed by another researcher, a Pentagon document that was Field Manual FM-30-31B, which details the methodology for launching terrorist attacks in nations that, quote, do not react with sufficient effectiveness, unquote, against communist subversion. Continuing on, Floyd writes, ironically, the manual states that the most dangerous moment comes when leftist groups renounce the use of force and embrace the democratic process. It is then that U.S. Army intelligence must have the means of launching special operations, and this is a quote from the Pentagon document, which will convince host country governments and public opinion of the reality of the insurgent danger. Well, if the so-called leftist danger have already embraced the democratic process, then obviously what's going on here is false flag operations to try to convince the public that they have not embraced the democratic process, once more to demonize the opposition. So we've been discussing what's gone on in London today, throwing some ideas around. It's a little too early to take a hard and fast decision as to what really happened. All we can do is play with probabilities and speculate and go on previous experience. So we're not making any accusations, we're just giving people some food for thought. One other point from the London bombings today was that it didn't take too long after the bombings that speculation turned to it being another Al-Qaeda operation, of course. And early on in the day, we were told that it was a previously unknown organization that was called the Secret Organization Group of Al-Qaeda Organization in Europe.
How's that for a title?
And this was before even any of the really the official announcements by officials in London had been released, and it was I think initially it was either the BBC or Sky News who had reported that they had received information from an Arab source who had this Arab source had received information that it was Al-Qaeda. So I mean, this was information that was passed along, and of course subsequent to that it seems that the entire thing has all the hallmarks of past quote-unquote Al-Qaeda operations.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable that people would immediately jump to that conclusion because the Arab terrorist threat, particularly after 9/11 and the various attacks that have happened since that, that Al-Qaeda is so pervasive, or that, better said, the Islamic terror threat is so pervasive that who else is it going to be in this day and age? This isn't a testimony to how good Al-Qaeda is at carrying out attacks or how they've kind of cornered the market, the global market on terrorism, but simply how good the American government and the British government are at their propaganda and their demonization of Arab people in general, because their goal is essentially to invade all of the Middle East and restructure the Middle East. So what better way to garner public support for that than by creating or manufacturing this all-pervasive Arab terrorist threat? But it's interesting to note that on every occasion that there has been an attack by a so-called Islamic terrorist group, that in almost every case it's an unknown or a previously unknown, the way it's phrased is that it's a previously unknown group affiliated or associated with Al-Qaeda, and that they usually post their admission or of guilt, or they claim responsibility for the attack on some obscure website. And we'd just like to make the point, or ask our listeners to think about just how easy it is for, with the resources of the intelligence agencies of a nation state, a large nation state like Britain or the US or Israel, which is, while it's small, it's immensely wealthy and powerful, obviously with backing and financing to the tune of billions of dollars every year from the US, how easy it would be for such a the intelligence agency of such a state to plant some bombs and then just walk away, let them explode, and then have someone else setting up phoning in a call to a radio station, or putting a posting of a responsibility on a website. I mean, that's just it's so simple for them to do that. And that's really the problem. There's no real way for any of us to verify the claims of our government officials. And what we essentially have to fall back on is the idea that they wouldn't do that. That these people, our leaders, are tasked with the responsibility of caring for us and looking out for our security and our needs. But again, the problem with that is that all you have to do is observe these people, listen to them speak, look at what they look at their intentions and their essentially their policies, to see that these people are in no way decent, responsible, upstanding members of the community. They're essentially people who have been corrupted by power, and there is literally nothing that they wouldn't do to ensure that they maintain that power, and indeed that they increase their power.
Well, the coffee cups are empty, and that was our agreed-upon sign for the ending of the discussion. We'll be back next week with a look at George W.'s growing unpopularity at home. You can write us at podcast@signsofthetimes.org. That's signs-of-the-times.org. And you can also read our daily look at world events on the website, www.signsofthetimes.org. Once more, signs-of-the-times.org. See you next time.